Lions, tigers, and bears have been the stars of fairy tales and the stuff of our nightmares. Large, fierce predators who inhabit the top of the food chain right alongside us. Naturalist and science writer David Quammen makes the case in his new book, Monster of God, that these alpha predators are likely to become extinct in the next 150 years or so, and that their passing is a devastating loss to our ecosystem and our identity as large predators ourselves. Quammen is the author of 9 previous books of fiction and nonfiction, including The Song of the Dodo and Natural Acts. He's a former columnist for Outside Magazine. For his new book, he visited conservation programs and sanctuaries from Wyoming to India to Siberia, observing along the way Komodo dragons, Romanian brown bears, giant snakes, and saltwater crocodiles. Before we talk about some of the conservation programs that you investigated for the book, I want to ask what might be an incredibly obvious question with a very obvious answer. Why are large predators rare? Is it because they're so big and prized and feared that we've hunted them to near extinction?
They're rare for a couple of reasons. Big predators are inherently rare because they live spaced apart on the landscape, spaced apart by their own hunger and ferocity. They're rare because they sit atop a food chain, and the species that are at the top of a food chain are always less abundant than the species that they feed on. They reproduce more slowly. There is less energy that filters up through the food chain to support them. So big predators are always inherently rare, but nowadays on this planet they're more rare than ever because they have been among the first to be exterminated over large parts of the planet.
What's an example of a conservation program, then, that works? And I'm thinking of the situation in Australia, and the conservation program is aimed to preserve habitat for a species of saltwater crocodile. It's in Kakadu National Park in the north of the country.
The saltwater crocodile in Australia is an extraordinary success story. Yeah, it was much depleted, almost exterminated during the 1940s and 50s after the Second World War because people came in with motorboats, battery beams, and high-powered rifles to hunt for saltwater crocodiles at night. The reason they hunted for them was because the saltwater crocodile has the most valuable skin of any crocodilian for leather products. Its belly skin is smooth, soft, and tans particularly well for high-end leather products like Gucci purses, things like that. So during a short period of years in the 40s and 50s, something like 89,000 crocodile skins were exported from the Northern Territory of Australia. By the 1960s, they were very rare. And then the various state governments and the government of Australia put limitations first in a complete ban and later restrictions on exports on the harvest of saltwater crocodiles. Because saltwater crocodiles reproduce fairly quickly, they lay large litters of eggs, and because the habitat had been preserved, they bounced back extremely well. And now there are something on the order of 75,000 adult saltwater crocodiles just in the Northern Territory of Australia. That means that the saltwater crocodile is certainly one of the most abundant of the big predators, of the alpha predators on the planet. 75,000 is far beyond what you'd find for any of the big cats or even probably the brown bear. So it has been a success, and one of the reasons it's been a success is because they have given some economic incentive to preservation of habitat by allowing people again now to harvest saltwater crocodiles for their skins.
You also describe a not so successful program in India to protect the same species of crocodile as the ones in Australia. Why is this program foundering when the same one works in Australia? And I think it's an example of how complicated this preservation endeavor is, especially since it's involving indigenous peoples.
It is complicated, and it's further complicated by the heartbreaking realities of millions of poor people trying to survive on a landscape. That's the big difference between eastern India, where the saltwater crocodile was once widespread, and northern Australia, where the saltwater crocodile is still widespread and abundant. In eastern India, the areas of habitat are heavily settled and under increasing pressure by very poor people who are building dikes. One particular place that I visited was the Brahmani Baitarani River Delta in the state of Orissa, eastern India, in an area particularly called the Bitarkanika National Park and surroundings. There are millions of poor people living along the lowland banks of these mangrovey delta areas, and there are also saltwater crocodiles that have begun to recover since being reintroduced by the Indian government in the 1970s. Now the saltwater crocodiles are beginning to thrive again in this area. They're coming out of the river. They're going into fish ponds kept by the poor local people. They're occasionally killing a dog, a small girl, an adult man. And I visited a couple of villages in this area and talked with people about their feelings toward the saltwater crocodile. And they are just agonized by the fact that this dangerous beast, which at one point was exterminated, has been brought back, restored to their ecosystem, and they're living too close to it, in too much vulnerable intimacy, to appreciate it the way we can appreciate it from a distance. So that was a case of a very well-meaning reintroduction program for a threatened species that didn't take account of the local people, their needs, their fears, their financial concerns, their cultural traditions. And the saltwater crocodile is continuing to plague them even now.
Let's talk about bears. One person who had a special fondness for trophy predators, especially bears, was Nicolae Ceaușescu, the dictator who brutally ruled Romania for 2 decades. How did Ceaușescu come onto your radar when you were researching this book?
The case of Romania and Ceaușescu is really peculiar. I got interested in it when I read somewhere that there were 5,000 brown bears surviving in the Carpathian Mountains of Romania. Brown bear is Ursus arctos. That's the same species as the grizzly bear in the western U.S. It exists across northern Asia, northern Europe, into North America. But you wouldn't think of 5,000 brown bears being able to survive in Romania, which most people would envision as a blighted, industrialized, Eastern European former communist bloc country. So I started going to Romania. I made a number of trips there, and simply looking for an answer to the question, why are there still 5,000 brown bears in Romania? The answer to that is again complicated, but it has a lot to do with the fact that Nicolae Ceaușescu ruled for 25 years, and he came to consider himself not only the grand chief, the dictator, the political commander in chief, but also the hunter in chief of Romanian forests, and he took a fancy to bear hunting, and so for most of 25 years. He hunted far more bears than any single individual should, but he allowed almost no one else to kill any of them. Consequently, the bear population rose not just to 5,000, but to almost 8,000 bears toward the end of Ceaușescu's rule. Essentially, the Romanian Forest Department was farming bears with supplemental food for Ceaușescu to kill.
Well, you talked to a number of people who worked in the system and pretty much said as much. They would feed a bear so that it would become enormous so that Ceaușescu could claim this trophy, right?
I did. I traveled around and talked to a lot of gamekeepers and wildlife managers for the Romanian Forest Department, and these fellows had tales to tell about the hunts that they had managed for Ceaușescu, about the bears that they had grown. Essentially, the Romanian forest in the Carpathian Mountains is divided up into a number of hunting units, 2,200 hunting units. Most of those have bear populations in them. Each of them has at least one gamekeeper whose job it is to care for, nurture, and know about two dozen individual bears that live in his hunting area. He gives them rotten apples. He gives them plums in the fall. He gives them a synthesized bear chow. He occasionally hangs up the carcass of a horse from an abattoir. He feeds these bears and bulks them up for trophy hunting purposes. And during the years of Ceausescu's reign, the only person who had access to those hunting opportunities was him, with some marginal bit of sharing with the other high muckamucks in the Communist Party, and occasionally a visitor like Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm thinking that you draw another conclusion from the case study of bears in Romania and also the case of lions in India and crocodiles in Australia, and it has to do with colonialism, that exterminating large predator species was one more way that colonial powers exert their dominance and their power over subjugated nations. It's really part of the colonial process, part of the human process, right? We're colonizing the earth.
But particularly part of the colonial enterprise in the political sense. This is very interesting. It's true of Australia. When white people invaded Australia and began taking the land and subjugating the Aboriginal people, part of the enterprise was also exterminating the big dangerous predators. If you want to subjugate a native people, one of the steps is to kill off their familiar local monsters. It happened in Australia for commercial reasons in terms of the harvest of skins. It happened in India during the British Raj. British officers took an enormous toll on the lions and also on the tigers of India. It happened elsewhere. It happened in the Western U.S. I mean, part of the quote-unquote settling of the Northern Rockies, for instance, by white people, and the subjugation of the Native Americans there involved essentially the extermination of the grizzly bear and the wolf. This is one of the things that has interested me most about the whole subject of big predators. It's the question of who pays the cost and who reaps the benefits. Big predators are dangerous, inconvenient, and expensive, especially so to the local people, the native people, the indigenous people who share landscape with them, like the Maldaris in the Gir Forest, like the Aboriginal people in northern Australia sharing their rivers and their beaches with the saltwater crocodile, like the shepherds in the mountains of Romania that I talked to, other cases across the planet. This is what was particularly interesting to me. I wanted to know, what's it like for the people who actually live surrounded by big predators? What does this state of constant jeopardy feel like to them? And is there any way that society can arrange things such that it's not the poor local people who pay the costs of big predators and the distant nature-loving people in cities across oceans who enjoy the benefits of knowing that big predators still exist on the planet?
I'm curious if, after writing about large predators, you've done so much thinking about the psychological, the gigantic psychological meaning that these creatures hold for human beings. What does it mean to us not to have alpha predators living side by side with us in some capacity anymore?
I think the most important service they have performed in, not in ecological, but in psychological and spiritual terms for us, is that they have reminded us throughout human history that we don't sit atop the food chain of power and glory, or the literal food chain of who eats whom. They have reminded us by occasionally preying on us that we, Homo sapiens, aren't apart from nature. We're not distinct from nature. We're not above nature. We're part of nature. We're within nature. They've reminded us that we're just another flavor of meat.
Well, David Quammen, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Barbara. It's been a pleasure.
David Quammen's new book is Monster of God.